You are Locked On Hawks, your daily Atlanta Hawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 352 of the Locked On Hawks podcast. I am your host, Brad Roland, coming to you live on this fine Thursday evening and into Friday morning. And joining me on the podcast today to tackle a myriad of subjects, I'm sure, the great Jeff Siegel. What's up, Jeff?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm all right, man. It's one of those things. You know, it's March 1st as we record this, so it's the first podcast of March officially. You know, last night's show I recorded deep into the night to the point where it was probably close to March, but now that we're in March, sort of the dog days of the NBA season for a lot of teams, including the Hawks, of course, as they're far out of the playoffs. So, you know, it's one of those things where only diehards are really cued in at the moment, but I think you and I qualify for that, so plenty of stuff to talk about. Let's start with a non-Hawks topic because I think that'll be interesting to go there. I've talked a little bit about the Jimmy Butler injury and how that might affect the Hawks draft pick this year that they probably will be getting from Minnesota. You know, a little bit's happened since then, but I have 538 queued up and some of the other stuff. And as of this moment, of course, we're recording Thursday evening, so it's like, you know, their game's happening right now. In fact, the Wolves play later tonight, so this is going to be slightly out of date. But they're projecting Minnesota to finish 48-34. And with the, I believe it's the fourth seed in the Western Conference, according to this, or no, actually the third seed, which is kind of funny. They have them projected to still finish ahead of Portland and San Antonio. With that said, that 530 doesn't know that Jimmy Butler's not going to be there, so that seems a little bit high. But is there any worry on your end that the Hawks will not be getting this draft pick? Because I think that's been a topic of conversation, and you know, it's worth diving in a little bit deeper on that.
I don't think that they're really in danger of falling out of the playoffs and losing that pick for the Hawks. I really just, you know, if you look at what their team has been great at this year, they're a great offensive team and they're a terrible defensive team. So the people who are going to sort of pick up their usage on both ends, both, you know, sort of as offensive players and defensive players, are going to be Andrew Wiggins and Karl-Anthony Towns, who are both either solid or wonderful offensive players, depending on how you feel about Wiggins. And they're both subpar defenders, but they're terrible on defense anyway, so how much worse is it really going to get? So I'm really not, like, I don't see how, you know, obviously missing Jimmy Butler for the whole year, not having Jimmy Butler at all would be a problem for Minnesota. But, you know, for a short stretch here, and we know how much Tibbs likes to play his players, you know, I think especially Towns, who has been on the lower end of his usage so far this year, can just sort of step right into that offensive role and just take those shots and take those touches, and they'll be just fine.
Yeah, I think they're certainly worse without Butler. And this honestly will end up helping the Hawks, in my opinion. Now, there was a little bit of that worry initially when it happened. Like, if you look at the numbers, they've not been very good when Jimmy Butler doesn't play this year. So there's a little bit of reason to worry because, you know, they only have like a 4-game lead over the 9 seed. But, you know, when you think about that, take a step back, 4 games and a 4-game margin or so with only 20 games or so to play is a pretty big margin. So they'd have to almost go in the tank here to the point where they probably have to finish something like 5-13 or 6-12 to really be in some serious peril. And I don't think that's necessarily a likely outcome because they still have, I mean, if they have another injury or two, then it could certainly happen. But if not, if their current roster makes it through until Butler returns, I think you're probably going to see them somewhere, I don't know, maybe the 6 seed range. Do you think they're going to still stay in that top 4 or 5? Or is it a situation where the Hawks could actually see some tangible benefit with their draft pick here?
Yeah, I mean, I think they could drop a few games that they wouldn't have dropped otherwise. You know, somewhere in that 5 or 6 seed makes sense instead of 48 wins like 538 has them projected for. Somewhere in like the 45-46 range, it's not going to be a huge drop off just because there's so few games left in the season. Like you were saying, if they miss him for the whole year, that's a much different thing. He's worth a handful of wins over the course of the whole year, but only over the course of 18-20 games. He's not worth more than maybe 1.5 or 2 wins.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's only an 18-20 game sample here. It's actually 18, including the game tonight. When people listen to this on Friday morning, they will already know the result of the Minnesota game on Thursday. But as of the time of this recording, they have a 1.5 game lead over the seventh seed. So there is some flux here, but I do think it would take a bit of a meltdown to have them miss the playoff, which is good. You know, at the end of the day, you're never rooting for an injury, and obviously, you and I cover the whole league as a general rule. It's never fun to think about Jimmy Butler not being there for Minnesota, but this is probably going to help the Hawks, even if only by a spot or two in the draft. And you can't necessarily argue with that a whole lot if you are a Hawks fan. All right, well, let's get off of that and talk about some Hawks stuff. First and foremost, I think you and I talked about this guy a lot, but I feel like I don't talk about him a whole lot on the podcast because it's just sort of not that interesting in a lot of different ways. But I think Dwayne Dedmon is worthy of some conversation here because he was very good on Wednesday night, and he's been pretty darn good all season long. He's not been quite as good since he returned from the injury, but there have been some flashes of that. And really, his jump shooting, you posted some videos on Twitter and that kind of stuff, talking about Dedmon's jump shooting, just sort of how crazy that is. So let's just talk about him a little bit. We'll start with shooting, I suppose, in that, you know, Dedmon right now for the season is still shooting 40.2% from three, which is unthinkable. You know, the volume's not too huge. It's about two attempts a game. But, you know, obviously we talked about it being a surprise, but it feels like it's real, and that's pretty crazy for his value.
Yeah, it feels like it's real just because, like, it's, you know, it's getting to the point where two attempts a game over, you know, a 50-game sample is, you know, you're getting somewhere with that. And you just watch him, and you watch how his jumper comes together both in warmups and in the games, and it looks like, you know, it looks like he's 6'7" and shooting a normal jump shot. You know, it doesn't look like one of these centers, you know, like I always like to think of Al Horford in his jumper where he, you know, gets off the ground about, you know, half an inch and doesn't, you know, it just looks odd, even though Horford's goes in as well. Dedmon's looks like, you know, looks like you would teach a guy how to shoot the way Dedmon shoots. You know, he just, everything is perfect mechanically, and it looks fantastic. And so, you know, the fact that it's going in, by the looks of it, doesn't surprise me, other than the fact that he's never really been able to do this so far in his career. You know, he was 79% at the rim last year in terms of his total shots. He took 79% of them at the rim. Now it's just 34%. He's shooting really well from mid-range, really well from three, and it seems like that's something that's sustainable and something that he'll carry into next year, whether he's with the Hawks or not.
Yeah, I mean, there are positives and negatives to guys who float more on the perimeter than they previously did. You know, I'm sure somebody somewhere is going to complain about Dedmon not being on the interior enough, but if you're going to shoot 40% from three, I'm not sure it's 40% good. I mean, that's probably overstating it just a little bit, even though it may not be. That's how good it looks, but I will look back to the preseason and just seeing him take that first three in a game that I was at and kind of just looking around like, that looked really good. Like, where did that come from, kind of thing? And, you know, the Hawks talked about letting him shoot, but I never saw this coming to this volume and to this effectiveness. So it's been huge for him. Honestly, you know, you look at the numbers right now, he now leads the team in true shooting percentage. He's now past John Collins with a 63% true shooting for the season. Again, I don't think necessarily that 40% is real, but he's shooting 58% from the floor as well. And if you can make him into a solid, maybe even a slightly above average offensive player, that would be huge because he's already a functional, pretty solid defensive player. So if you have a two-way big that has mobility and rim protection and shooting ability, that's suddenly a very intriguing player. And I think we both have been pretty high on him this season. But at the same time, like, any thought of him opting in, I think kind of goes out the window. In my opinion, I think it's clearly possible that he could still, but I just, if you're Dedmon's agent, if he plays like this the rest of the way, I just can't see advising him to keep that deal.
Yeah, I would be advising him to opt out. You know, it doesn't make sense. You can always go somewhere and sign another 1 year or 2 year deal if you really want to get back on the market when there's more money in 2019 or 2020. But for now, like, there's got to be somewhere out there that you can make more than $6.3 million. There's got to be somewhere that will pay you commensurate to more of your value, even if it's just like the mid-level exception somewhere. Take that for 1 year. Take that for 1 year plus a player option and evaluate yourself at the end of the next year.
Yeah, I just, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, I will go back. It was a little bit weird when he got benched the other night, and we haven't heard anything really about that other than I played the audio for everybody about the coach's decision, quote from Mike Budenholzer. That was a little bit weird, but he sort of has been playing a full workload since then, so I'm not sure what we take away from that, if anything at all. But, you know, aside from that, man, nothing's really gone poorly for Dedmon. Obviously, the team's not been great, but that's not his fault in any stretch of the imagination. I think, you know, looking at this, and I was going to ask about this guy in a second, somebody asked me offline this week if I thought Dedmon had been the best player for the Hawks this season, and I said no, pretty quickly. I was, you know, sort of leaning on Kent Bazemore more, but with the way that Kent's struggled actually a little bit more recently, and we'll talk about that in a second. Deadman's sort of in the conversation as the best player, or at least the most positive player overall for the Hawks. I think without the injury, he almost certainly would be. If these were his numbers all season long, I think I would be caping for him more. You know, the only argument against him would be the fact that he's only played about half the minutes of a guy like Prince or Schroeder, which, you know, I still think I would go with Deadman. He's only played 1,000 minutes or so, whereas, you know, Kent Bazemore would probably still be my pick at 1,700 minutes, and that's just more impactful when you play that much more. But is that a conversation for you? Do you think he's actually maybe been the best player for the Hawks this season?
Yeah, I think he's probably been the second most valuable after Bazemore, but like in terms of just most outstanding, like he's been the best in his minute per minute basis. Deadman's been the best player, I think, you know, especially with the shooting, with the rim protection inside, with his ability to defend fours and fives. They've got him defending some fours now, you know, especially when they play him with Collins, which I think we'll talk about in a minute, that Collins is sort of playing center, even though he's more of a power forward size. Deadman's just able to be so much more versatile. I think he's been better on a per minute basis than Bazemore has, but Bazemore's probably been more valuable overall just because you're getting what you're getting from him for, you know, 70% more possessions and more time out there.
Yeah, I agree with that pretty much all the way together. Let's just talk about Collins now since you mentioned it. Those guys have been playing pretty well together this season. I'm not sure that's an ideal pairing necessarily. It's one that I don't hate at all. I think if the Hawks were able to keep Deadman long term, that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, but, you know, he's a little bit older, obviously. I don't think he's going to be necessarily in the plans as a long-term piece for the Hawks, but you can sort of see what that looks like with Collins playing next to another traditional big, provided that traditional big can also shoot in the way that Deadman can. If Deadman couldn't shoot, if this was Deadman from last year or the year before that, when he wasn't a shooter at all, I'm not sure that would work offensively a whole lot, but with Deadman's ability to step out and shoot it and be a little bit, you know, at least reasonably mobile defensively, that's looked good. But, I mean, what have you seen from Collins in general and, I guess, alongside traditional bigs? Because right now, all four of the bigs that the Hawks have to use right now are pretty much all centers. You know, Muscala can obviously play some four, Collins can play some four, but, you know, as a general rule, I think all four of those guys are primary centers. So it's been, I would say, less than ideal in terms of lineup construction, but Collins has still played pretty, you know, fairly well and obviously leads the team still in PER and some of the advanced metrics.
Yeah, I think Collins is playing the four if you just sort of look at the roster and just say, like, okay, he's not as tall as Deadman, but, like, by all, sort of, eye test accounts, I suppose Collins is really playing the five and Deadman's the four. Deadman's the one getting out on the perimeter a little more. Deadman's the one, you know, getting out on the perimeter defensively and offensively. You know, he's switching. He can guard, you know, some threes and twos on late clock switches. He's, of course, shooting the three like we've been talking about. Collins really hasn't been, you know, stepping out and shooting the three as much. He's much more inside. He's much more of a traditional center offensively. And then defensively I still think he's a bit of a mess defensively, but he's coming along a little bit better than I would have expected, at least from a rookie. You know, obviously that pairing has been pretty solid, you know, almost 700 possessions now for them. And, you know, they're just slightly below, you know, slightly below zero in terms of a net rating. But when you compare that to the rest of the Hawks, like, that's actually pretty damn good. And, you know, that new starting group of Schroeder, Bazemore, Prince, Collins, and Deadman is plus 2.1 per 100 possessions. You know, it's just 147 possessions for that group, but that's still really solid. And that looks, you know, that it passes my eye test in terms of, like, what makes sense for both an offense and a defense. Deadman can sort of be a switchy rim protector who can space the floor. Collins is a threat on the roll and has gravity in that way. And then, you know, of course, Schroeder and Bazemore and Prince are really the starting three in terms of the point guard, shooting guard, and small forward. No other real combination makes sense there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's worth noting that, you know, Collins' block rate's one of the top 10 in the league, which is pretty crazy. There's been some strengths for him that I didn't see coming. So I think people are almost overrating his defense at this point in time. I still think Collins has been way better than I thought he was going to be, and he's not killed the Hawks by any means on that end of the floor. I do think he's got some work to do defensively. I think some of the numbers probably treat him a little bit better than my eye test does. He does make some highlight plays, but I just think on a per possession basis, he's a rookie. It's what happens. I mean, he makes mistakes that rookies make, and I'm not really worried about that because he's already improved quite a bit. All of the all the coaches and player development guys seem to all love working with John. I think he's been a quick learner and a quick study, so I'm not worried at all, honestly, about his defense anymore. I think there's probably still a ceiling on that to some degree with some of his strengths and weaknesses, but at the same time, like, him already being a a guy who doesn't kill you defensively is pretty significant. And I do wonder, I guess, a little bit about him as a pure center, which is where I think he's going to be the best. But, you know, again, with this roster right now, the only guy on the team this year that he's been playing with that's actually a power forward in today's NBA is probably Ursula Mesova, who's no longer there. So I think the jury's still kind of out on him as a primary, you know, solo rim-protecting five. But aside from that, you know, and by the way, on the perimeter, as you mentioned, like having Deadman do that is probably because Collins isn't super comfortable doing that. I would have to imagine that because it's not like Deadman's this, like, otherworldly perimeter defending athlete kind of big man. Like, he's a pretty good athlete, but he's not like this guy who you would think necessarily would be flying around the perimeter. So I think I do wonder how much of that is them just not wanting Collins to be exposed like that.
Yeah, it would be nice if Collins could do a little bit more of that, only because, you know, as much as he's, you know, doing very well in terms of block percentage and blocks per game and everything like that, he jumps for blocks that he shouldn't jump for, and it leads to offensive rebounds, and that's a small problem. And so if he could be more of a sort of help on the perimeter and more of a weak side shot blocker rather than sort of a primary rim protector, I think that would be better. But, you know, as it goes, he's playing more of a traditional center role with Deadman out on the perimeter. As the team sort of evolves, we'll see sort of where that goes. But the rebounding is a big issue. Collins' individual rebounding rate's not great. His team rebounding rate when he's on the floor versus off the floor is downright putrid. I mean, they're giving up a ton more offensive rebounds when he's on the floor versus off. And, you know, they're never been a good defensive rebounding team. Like, it's just other than that one blip last year with Dwight Howard. But, like, they've just, you know, the Hawks have never really valued the defensive glass that well. And Collins fits right into that because he just jumps after blocks all the time. And, you know, he jumps into passing lanes to try to find steals and stuff. And he's been solid at that. But it's a problem on the defensive glass a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an important note because I think, you know, you see his total rebound numbers, and a lot of that's just him being a very good offensive rebounder already. He's super active. There's no reason he couldn't be a good defensive rebounder in the future, but the block rate is because he jumps for everything, which is not that big of a problem right now. I mean, he's got some growth to be worked on there in terms of his technique and his decision making as a rim protector around the rim. You don't always have to get blocks, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think, you know, the rebounding has been a mess. You know, you look at the numbers, only Deadman on the entire roster has a more than 22% defensive rebound rate. That's pretty bad. That's kind of how you lead to a team that's really bad on defensive glass. And that's, unfortunately, it's not Collins' fault, but, you know, both he and Mike Muscala, especially, that's probably their biggest weakness right now in terms of their defense. But for both those guys, neither one of them is going to be good rebounders. Obviously, Al Horford's biggest weakness as he was sort of growing, you know, early on in his career, he was a pretty good rebounder. But after that, you know, by the time he left Atlanta, it was pretty much his sole weakness defensively was that he couldn't dominate the defensive glass. So not a new problem at all for the Hawks. But hopefully, Collins can improve there because you've already seen, like, he has the burst to be able to do it defensively, but it's very different skill to defensive rebound versus offensive rebound. Offensively, he could just sort of let himself loose, be an athlete, and fly around, whereas defensively, it's a lot more about, you know, positioning, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a lot more about positioning, just decision-making, not jumping for that to block that floater that you've got no real chance of going after, but you might get one out of every 20 times. He'll develop that. I mean, he's obviously still just a rookie. He's still really young. They'll work with him on that. They'll get him to be a better decision maker over the next few years. And it's not a permanent problem. It's not something where, you know, like with Horford, you just sort of looked at him and it was like, oh, you're kind of undersized. You're not that great of an athlete. Collins isn't, you know, particularly undersized. He is a pretty solid athlete. Can sort of develop the strength down low to, you know, both as a decision maker and as just like physically being able to box out and stuff. So I'm not super concerned about his long-term, you know, potential as a rebounder, but it is sort of a small problem right now.
For sure. We can move on, Collins. There's obviously plenty of time to talk about him. I do want to ask you about one guy who's playing very well recently, and that's Isaiah Taylor. The last four games for Taylor, when he's been basically the primary backup point guard with Delaney injured, and then, you know, Delaney came back on Wednesday but didn't play a whole lot in that game. Taylor is averaging 14.8 points per game and 4.5 assists over those four games in only 21 minutes, shooting the heck out of the ball from the field, 64%. It's a very small sample, obviously. But, you know, Taylor he started off really well for the Hawks in his early appearances, then sort of cooled off quite a bit. I think Bud has been sort of hot and cold on him a little bit in the way that you read between the lines with some quotes this year. But what have you seen from him, knowing that for me, I'll just say this, I think my biggest concern with Taylor is probably still his shooting, where he's shooting 29% from three and not taking a whole lot of three-point attempts. I think he's going to have to make shots to be a real NBA point guard. But what have you seen from him recently?
I mean, I think the biggest thing with him is that the team doesn't have to play differently when he comes on for Dennis Schroeder. It's sort of a weird thing that you can't really put a number on that. But the fact that his playing style is so similar to Schroeder's, in that he just wants to get in the paint and score, and he's not the best passer. He can't really shoot from outside, but he's faster than just about anybody other than Dennis Schroeder, maybe. And he can just get into the rim. He can get to the rim. He gets fouled really well. You know, he doesn't shoot well from the free throw line, which is kind of a concern for his long-term ability to be an efficient player from anywhere, from outside or from just from the free throw line itself. You know, I don't see him really developing a shot, because his free throw shooting has been, you know, pretty poor over his career at this point. So, you know, it seems like he's going to be one of those backup point guards who just is there to get to the rim, can make a few passes. He's probably a better passer than Schroeder, but not by a ton. And, you know, I think the biggest thing is that they can play the same style, whether he's in the game or it's Schroeder, because they're so similar. Whereas Delaney brings a very different style to the team as a backup point guard than Taylor does.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think offensively, I've been okay with Taylor this year for the most part. I do think, again, he needs to make more shots as a perimeter shooter and really just take more shots. That's a big thing, but I don't mind the way he operates the offense in general. I think defensively there's been some concern, and that's when you ask Budenholzer and some, and you hear some stuff around there, it's that I don't think they love him defensively, and that's a problem, because if you're going to be a guy who isn't transcendent offensively, even as a bench guard, you got to be able to defend, and he's not really done that this year. He's not terrible necessarily. He has some decent size, but I think, you know, the only guy in the backcourt this year that's been a passable defender for me is Malcolm Delaney, which makes him look better in some of the advanced numbers, all that stuff, because Schroeder and Taylor have been pretty bad defensively. So I don't know. It's sort of a Jerry Salah situation. I think, you know, Taylor, they have him under contract for next year, and as a result of that, you want to at least keep tabs on him, because, you know, a lot of the roster won't be here next year. Same thing with Tyler Cavanaugh when he comes back. I think those guys are not necessarily these huge value chips for the future, but they're both on their team next year if they want them to be, for basically no money. So if you want to take flyers on those guys, then sure. I think Taylor's shown enough to tell me that he's an NBA player. I'm just not sure what there is beyond that, basically, is kind of where I am right now.
Yeah, I think he's definitely an NBA player. I think his ability to get to the rim, the elite quickness, the elite sort of speed and explosive aspect to his game is going to keep him in the league for as long as he keeps those attributes, which should be, you know, the next 4, 5, 6 years. And then we'll see where he is as his sort of age comes for his quickness and his speed and his athleticism. You know, if he's developed a little more of a passing game, a little bit more of a jump shot, that would be great. You know, he did shoot, I think, 46% in the G League last year from three, which seems amazing compared to what we've seen from him in the NBA. But at least there's some sort of history there, that he's made shots at some level, at some NBA level, from the NBA three-point line. You know, it's not like he, you know, made 46% of his threes in high school. Like, that wouldn't mean anything to me. But at least, you know, there's a history of, if he's been open, he can make those shots. And of course, you know, it's just, you know, maybe the NBA just hasn't quite happened for him yet, but there's at least something there that he might be able to shoot from long range. I don't, you know, it still doesn't seem like he's going to develop that skill. To me, I don't see it there. But, you know, you never know what Hawks University might be able to bring out of him.
Yeah, and to be fair, it's only like 50 attempts or something like in his NBA career, you know, beyond the G League. So it's not like this is a huge sample of him shooting 29%. I'm not sure he's that kind of non-shooter. I just don't think he's necessarily a guy who's going to suddenly shoot high 30s regularly either. That's sort of, there's a middle ground there, and it kind of depends on where he lands there as well. And look, Taylor's 23 years old. Like, he's a guy who's young enough to actually be somebody you can invest in as a developmental piece. Like, he wasn't this like huge NBA draft prospect, but before he got to Texas, he was a pretty big time recruit. There's some pedigree there with Taylor that there isn't necessarily with a couple of other guys that the Hawks have had around in these fringe roles. So I think there's probably some growth to be had there. Just not 100% sure what's going to happen, but, you know, they have him for no money. It's basically moving forward. And for right now, I think he'll at least be in the mix for next year. I'd imagine they probably give him a good long, hard look in terms of making the roster and keeping him around for 2018, 2019.
Yeah, I would assume that he'll be around for next year just because he's on a minimum contract. If they want to get rid of him at some point throughout the year, they can just, you know, either dump him in a trade or just straight up waive him, just because, you know, they're gonna be a team that operates with cap space anyway, so it's not imperative that they lose his minimum contract so that they open up cap space for some mystery free agent that's definitely not coming.
I love mystery free agents. It's the best. Okay, last thing before I let you get out of here. I wanted to ask you about Kent Bazemore because I've appraised Kent a lot this year. I think he's played very well, but in February he's really struggling in terms of his efficiency. He's shooting 35% from the floor in February. It's only 10 games or so, but I think for the season now that's really starting to affect some of his overall numbers in terms of his efficiency. It's not, you know, for Kent, he's a guy who is the only quality perimeter defender on the roster, I would actually stress at this point in time, at least on a nightly basis. I think you know, the runner up there would probably be Delaney, but those two guys are the only ones that I think are at least average or better defensively at the moment. So there's that workload, and he's still shooting well from three, 38% from 3-point land this season, but only 41% from the floor, and that kind of hurts his true shooting, all that fun stuff. So I'm not saying he's been struggling, but probably hasn't been quite as good recently, and the team's performance has suffered. I think he's probably a little bit frustrated by the lack of winning, all that stuff. But have you seen anything different from Kent, or is this a situation where he's just kind of sort of cooled off a little bit?
Yeah, I think he's just sort of cooled off, even though he wasn't particularly hot to start the year in terms of his own scoring efficiency for himself. He's just not, like, he's just not that kind of scorer to really need to have the ball in his hands so much, but he has the ball in his hands on this team just because they're so starved for creation. Like, you know, especially when Schroeder's doesn't really have it, you know, they've been giving him a lot of the primary ball handler responsibilities. And, you know, when it comes time for him to shoot the ball off the dribble or just get to the rim for his own layup, it just hasn't quite gone that well this year. It didn't really go well last year when they tried to do a little bit of that. But, you know, I still think, like, his development is sort of late development, even because he's already 28. His sort of late development as a primary ball handler, even as a secondary ball handler, is something that they can rely upon, you know, as he sort of continues on this contract that people seem to not very, you know, like, not like very much. But I think he's played solid. It's just about, you know, sort of honing his off the dribble jumper, his stuff like that will help him. And that's not something that is something that you have to develop for, you know, between 21 and 23. You can develop that anytime. And so, you know, if he can work on that over the summer, come back and hit, you know, a lot of those mid-range pull-ups, a lot of those three-point pull-ups, all of a sudden his efficiency goes through the roof. He, you know, passing lanes are more open, everything is more open. So, you know, it's not, I haven't lost hope that, you know, in these last few games that Kent has sort of just, you know, is hit the wall in that way. But I think he's just, you know, it's a long season. You're going to have ups and downs. I think this is just sort of a downswing for him.
Yeah, I agree. As long as he makes threes at a reasonable rate, it's going to be fine. I think, as you mentioned there, I think on a better team, he would certainly not have this kind of usage and his creation responsibility. He still has a 54% true shooting for the season, which is just fine. Like, it's not anything terribly exciting, but given the fact that he can defend and do a lot of different things for you, you can live with that. I think, you know, again, it's probably buoyed a little bit by his three-point shooting, which might be a little bit unsustainable. It's like, you know, 38-39%. That might be a new normal for Kent. It's not been that way previously, but, you know, if he's taking quality shots, he's certainly capable of shooting that kind of percentage in a long-term thing if he's just being smart about shot selection. So I just think he's played very well this season. You know, he's definitely cooled off a little bit in terms of efficiency in the last 10 games, but it's a 10-game sample for a guy who's playing a lot of minutes. And, yeah, I just want to sort of throw that out there. Somebody asked me about that earlier this week. Like, you know, have you seen that Kent struggling? You always praise him. I'm like, yeah, I understand. I praise him a lot. It's because, frankly, he's been the most consistent player on the team this year and been the best player. We said that early on the podcast talking about Dedmon. Bazemore has been the centerpiece this year. And, you know, it just in the same way as Schroeder, I will defend Schroeder in some ways in that, look, he's not a guy who needs to be having a 30% usage rate. And Bazemore's not that high, obviously. It's been higher than it needs to be, though. So you're placing guys in these outsized roles that they probably are not prepared for. And by the way, Taurean Prince is probably the same way. You know, Taurean, we talked about a lot on the last couple of podcasts. He had a good first half on Wednesday, but, you know, same sort of thing there. Dan talked about that as well this week. It's like, you know, it's not a guy that you want having the ball in their hands a lot. He's definitely more of a secondary player that happens to be in more of a primary role because the Hawks just don't have anybody else to get those shots, and somebody has to create and do something. So anyway, it's probably a long-winded answer, but one of those things that you just need to have perspective on all. Basically, this entire roster is in a different role. At least most of the roster is in a different role than they actually would be on a different slash good team.
Yeah, especially Bazemore, just the way he's creating so much more. His usage is up, but it's also just how that usage is coming. It's not that he's taking more shots from beyond the three-point line. It's really that he's has the ball in his hands, has to create for himself and others so much more. And so it's just, you know, with that is always going to be, you know, come a dip in efficiency, whether you're a point guard or, you know, or a wing like he is. And so it just, it seems, you know, it's not, I wouldn't look at his efficiency this year and be like, oh no, like something's wrong with his ability to shoot the ball. Cause he's been fine. He, you know, his catch and shoot numbers are fine. It's really just that he, you know, has had to create for himself. And when he has to sort of pull up for a mid-range jumper or try to get to the rim and finish, he just doesn't quite have the juice to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, like, I think people have, and I understand this, it's because Prince is younger and all this fun stuff. I think if you look at the numbers and the way, you know, Bazemore's still a better offensive player than Torian Prince right now. Like, you look at all the things that those guys do. Baze has a higher true shooting percentage. He has a higher assist rate. I believe he has a lower turnover rate, or at least a similar turnover rate. It's one of those things where, like, if you put those guys and just said offense only, I still take Bazemore. And Bazemore is a much better defensive player at this moment. Granted, I totally get it. You know, Prince is a lottery pick. He's younger. He's more of a prospect. I totally understand that. But I think people sort of equate that with being better than he actually is at this moment. And Bazemore is, you know, we've done this 100 times. But, you know, the fact that he's overpaid doesn't mean that he's not a good player. It's just one of those things.
Yeah, we've had that conversation a lot on here offline. Just, you know, just because he's still overpaid, but his value has gone up this year from what it was coming into the year. So, like, he's getting closer to being properly paid. I don't think he'll ever really get there, but like we talked about, or like I just talked about a minute ago, if he's, you know, if he's sticking those pull-up mid-rangers, those pull-up threes in defenders' eyes when, you know, next year, then all of a sudden he's now worth $15, $16, $17 million a year. It's just about, you know, whether he could do that or not. It's probably pretty rare for a guy to develop that sort of shot late in his career, but it's possible. And with Kent, you know, he's going to be working on it this summer. And so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he came out next year and was much improved in that area.
Yeah, there's no question at all about Kent's work ethic. That's something you never hear is anybody questioning Kent's work ethic. He's always trying to get better, and I think that might be a spot where he looks to improve this year. Anyway, well, Jeff, I appreciate the time as always, my man. Next time when you come on the podcast, we'll probably have to do the definitive deep dive on Jalen Morris. So be prepared for that.
I will. I'll prepare for that. That was. I'd have to look at him up close, you know, in warm-ups or whatever, but his shot did not look particularly good, you know.
I watched the warm-up on purpose before Wednesday's game. I actually watched a couple of games of Erie film again, just trying to see something about Morris, because honestly I've watched some Erie this year, but, you know, candidly, when I focus on Erie, I'm looking at the guys who are on the Hawks that are down there, whether that be at the time, whether it be Kavanaugh or Andrew White even, or, you know, any of these guys, you know, when Bembry was down earlier in the season. Those are the guys I'm trying to watch in Erie. I'm not trying to watch the guys who are not affiliated with the Hawks directly. So, you know, Morris is on the court when you see some of those guys, but it's going to be really tough to sell me on a guy who shoots 28% from three. That's just not a thing that is going to be sustainable. But listen, he played hard, and I'm not trying to crap on him. But it's just funny. They're going to see the revolving door of 10-day guys is going to probably continue for the last month or so. Antonius Cleveland is around. And at some point, if these guys end up sticking around, we will talk about them, I promise. People keep asking about those guys. It's like, guys, I'm not going to talk about them extensively because they may not be here next week. So.
Yeah, seriously. By the time we record this, by the time you release this, he might not be on the team anymore. So it's like, it's really, I'm not going to go, you know, deep dive into Jalen Morris when he's really only on a 10-day, even if he gets a second 10-day. Until somebody gets signed for the rest of the season, you know, we can just sort of see him, watch him in the game, and watch his jump shot be super broken. But, you know, I'm not going to go any deeper than that.
Yeah, it was a cool story to see the guy sign and then be on the court later that night. That's something you don't always see, and that's something you probably only see on a team like the Hawks that's not competing and that has some injury stuff. So, yeah, shouts to Jalen Morris. It might be the last time we talk about it on the podcast, but there it is. thank you again, Jeff. Plug anything you like, my friend. I always encourage people to follow your stuff, but tell them where they can find all of your writing.
You can follow me on Twitter at JG Seagull. I've been posting videos and I do cap stuff in the off season, but I've been doing a lot more X's and O's during the year if you're interested in that. You can follow the Hawk stuff on Peachtree Hoops. I'm going to have something coming out probably tomorrow, depending
today,
on when Brad
edits.
Today,
as people listen to this on Friday.
Today, as people listen to it. So on Friday, you'll see, you can go to Peachtree Hoops and find something I wrote about a play that that the Hawks ran to open the game against Indiana that I thought was particularly interesting and that I haven't seen from them or from any team in the league so far this year. So that was pretty fun. Those are kinds of X's and O's things that I like, is like literal X's and O's, not just like, oh, this guy's a good 3-point shooter, but like, this is how teams run their offense. And so I really, enjoy doing that. So you'll see a lot more of that, hopefully, from me on Peachtree Hoops, and probably more on the rest of the league. If you're looking for stuff on any other team, you can find that over at Fanside. It's the Step Back. I should have some stuff for them, this week, next week, and pretty much forever.
Yeah, pretty much forever indeed. It's that time of the year to where we'll be buckling down on some playoff stuff coming up soon, even though it won't be involving the Hawks. But at any rate, Peachtree Hoops is the place to find Jeff's Hawk stuff, so check that stuff out as well. Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. We'll have to do this again very shortly.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
As for everybody else, we will be back for a Saturday morning special edition podcast because the Warriors are in town on Friday night, so that'll be interesting. I will definitely recap the festivities following that contest, and if nothing else, we should all enjoy that one together because the Warriors only come to town once, so if you don't have your tickets yet, they'll probably be pretty expensive by Atlanta standards, but check them out, and I'll be there live and in person. We'll talk about that, and that'll be the next podcast on Saturday, so stay tuned for that.